You're listening to the Unofficial Expression Engine Podcast, episode 96. Today, we're talking to Ryan Battles about EE Aeropages. I'm your host, Emily Lewis. Unfortunately, my fab co-host, Leah Alcantara, isn't able to join us today, but we've got a special guest co-host filling in.
Anna Brown.
This episode is sponsored by Entry Analytics. Entry Analytics brings the performance metrics of Google Analytics directly into an Expression Engine site. View metrics for your individual entries in the control panel, create custom reports using template tags, and more with Entry Analytics, available at Devotee. The Expression Engine podcast would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for filling in for Leia today.
Hi, Emily. I'm really glad to be here. It's a pleasure to be invited. I really like what you guys are doing with the show and very happy to participate. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Well, you're also an active member of our community, so it's great to have you on board, especially not as a guest. You get to guide our guests today.
I will do my best.
All right. Well, let's kick off with a little EE news. It's been a long time since Leah and I talked about the EE Stack Exchange, but you've been an active and vocal supporter of the effort since it began. Would you mind filling our listeners in on where things stand and what's still needed with the EE Stack Exchange?
Sure. So as most people know, we're in public beta still for the Stack Exchange site. The Stack Exchange site can be found at expressionengine.stackexchange.com. The site, it really is a public support site for Expression Engine. There's not really an ETA for when it'll get out of public beta. That's really up to the Stack Exchange folks. But our numbers, to me, look great. We're at, we've just surpassed 3,000 questions on the site.
Wow.
We're at 4,600 answers, 1,600 users, about 1,100 visitors per day. And I think our stats are great. Definitely really great participation in the community. And I think going forward, we all just need to be better about visiting the site daily or as much as we're able to do and to answer questions and ask questions for that matter.
So you said the folks at Stack Exchange will be the ones to determine when it comes out of public beta. Do you know what their criteria is?
I don't know that that's very clear. They have probably an internal discussion about the longevity of the site. So they're looking to see if they launch it, they really don't take it back. So this is when they launch it to a true real site, then, you know, it's going to be there pretty much forever.
Awesome.
Wherever the numbers land, they then will make that decision. So I don't know what that point is, but I think we're doing exceptionally well. When you look at other sites that are in public beta, we compared to them are doing quite well.
So I have to admit that I haven't used Stack Exchange myself. I'm curious. And one of the reasons why is that I tell myself I don't really have time. And I know you're busy. So how do you make time to stay involved in Stack Exchange?
Well, I've been slacking a little bit, but in the beginning, I was exceptionally active. I just made it a part of my day. You know, in the mornings while I was drinking coffee, I took a look at the site. I answered questions that I could answer. I participated when I could. I'm not always available to do it, but I promoted on Twitter just to make sure that people remembered that it was there. So I was actively just reminding people daily, which generally helps to keep the momentum going. Participating doesn't mean answering questions either. I mean, you can be the person asking a question. So we need relevant questions to answer as well. So I would use it in that way if it works for you.
And I'm correct in that you can post a question and also answer it yourself?
Yes. Absolutely. And you can do that in the same, in the flow of actually asking the question. There's an option to answer it yourself. So if you feel that whatever situation you're in is applicable to other people and is something that should be archived, then this is a great place to do it. What I think some of us are seeing now is that when you Google an issue, these Stack Exchange questions and answers, for that matter, are coming up quite high in the search engine. So as that happens, more traffic will grow. People will know that the site is a great place to get public support from the community. And I'm just exceptionally proud of what we've been able to accomplish in 206 days.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
206 days we've been in public beta. And I would like to publicly thank Patrick for proposing this at the Expression Engine Conference last year, proposing this site. It has been proposed several times before in the 8 years I've worked with Expression Engine and just hasn't gained momentum. And I'm not sure exactly why it did this time, but I'm thrilled to see us as a community rally behind something that works for us, supports our daily jobs, and is a great tool for all other developers in this area. So very proud of us.
Excellent. Now, before we get to today's episode, you've been talking a little bit about your involvement promoting Stack Exchange, but can you tell our listeners just a little bit more about yourself and what you do each day?
Yep, absolutely. So, well, I'm here in Albuquerque, right down the road from you.
I know, I'm waving at you right now.
Are you? I don't see you enough for somebody who lives right down the road. So I'm based here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm actually in Corrales, which is on the north end of town. I'm a full-time Expression Engine freelance developer. I work for agencies, one particularly here in Albuquerque, and then a couple in San Francisco, and then sort of just random projects across the country. I've worked as a full-time freelancer for about 8 years now, and I wouldn't be doing anything else, really. I will be doing my first public talk on an Expression Engine project of mine at the Peers Conference at the end of June, and this is a conference in Chicago. It's June 26th through the 28th, so if anybody's looking for a conference in Chicago right around that time, please come and join us. We would love to have great participation at the conference, and I would love to have full room for my talk. Everybody should just know I'm extremely nervous.
So you mentioned you're nervous. This is your first time speaking. What made you decide to do it? Because I know that I had bugged you for a couple of years about doing some local stuff, and it just wasn't something that had interested you. So what's different this time?
Well, like I said, I've been a developer in the Expression Engine community for 8 years, but I've sort of lived, you know, I worked in a little bubble out here in New Mexico. I mean, there aren't a lot of developers here in Albuquerque. I mean, there are, but I don't know them. So I really was working in this bubble. And, you know, I was in the forums a little bit and a little bit in the community, but I didn't get to these conferences. So last year, I happened to win a ticket from a devotee for the EECI conference in Austin. So I had to go. So that was really sort of my stepping out in the community and meeting people for the first time. And, you know, honestly, I didn't understand the importance of that. And I'm just beyond thrilled that I won that ticket and that I had the opportunity to meet my community in person. And so when I was there, I realized that we needed more women to step up in this community to present and give talks and talk about our experiences as developers and our projects. I also knew that I had something to give back. I mean, I work on a project that I think is something of an anomaly in the Expression Engine community. And I've learned an enormous amount about Expression Engine and how it will work with how it scales with a high traffic site and a busy publishing site. So I have some valuable lessons to present. So when Jessica talked about putting peers together, I absolutely said, sign me up. And I'm thrilled to be presenting, very sort of humbled to be on the same stages as some of the other speakers. And I just hope I don't flub it. But so everybody, you know, rally and show up, please. I would love a full room of very familiar faces.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, very exciting. I'm really excited for you.
Very nervous.
All right, so let's get to today's episode. We're talking about EE Aeropages with Ryan Battles. Ryan is a web developer passionate about startups. He started his own Jovia web studio back in 2008, specializing exclusively in Expression Engine development, but last year he joined CrushPath as their lead front-end engineer. Welcome, Ryan. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Hi, Ryan. Great to see you, or great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to reconnect. I know that we all three of us connected down in Austin at EECI, so...
Yeah, so it was great to meet you there.
Yeah. I was just listening to you, you know, describe your story for getting down there. That's a pretty interesting story, and I'm glad you won the ticket as well.
Right, Ryan Masuga, thank you. It's really Ryan's fault that I got there. But thank you, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Ryan, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah. So I started off as a school teacher. I actually taught high school and junior high computer classes for 6 years before I decided that I wanted to go into business building web pages myself. I was teaching the students how to build web pages, and some of them had a passion for it and some of them didn't care. And after a while, it just kind of grated on me that, you know, these kids who were taking these classes didn't think it was that neat because I thought it was awesome. So I knew I had a calling to kind of start my own thing. So I left teaching and started Jovia Web Studio, as you said, and have been building pages for the web for the last, I guess that would be five years I've been doing it now professionally. So yeah, last year I decided to close up Jovia Web Studio after a great 4 years of serving clients. I just had a neat opportunity to join a startup in its early stages. I had a chance to meet the co-founder behind the startup. Seemed like a really great guy, a really interesting opportunity to get connected with. So I made a tough decision. I closed down my studio and started working full-time for these guys out of San Francisco. And it's been a great ride. Just the last year has been full of all kinds of learning opportunities and opportunities to work on items that I didn't really stretch myself to work on with clients. But now that I'm working on a web app, there's a lot more front-end code that I'm being exposed to that I would have normally. So, but we still use Expression Engine. We use Expression Engine for our marketing site for CrushPath. And any side projects that I do, Expression Engine is my go-to. I still am very active in running Directory, the online community of Expression Engine developers, and the official Expression Engine job board. So yeah, have side projects and spend my days working for CrushPath.
So your job with CrushPath is a developer?
Yes, yeah. The front end. I'm the head of the front end development there. So lots of JavaScript, HTML, CSS, bug fixes, things like that. We have a. It's nice to be on a team full of talented people who, you know, have strong back end skills, because that stuff used to scare me a lot with.
I've
never built a plugin or anything for Expression Engine, so all that stuff, you know, I always just bought what was out there. So it's nice to be surrounded by other talented people.
I agree. I was the same way. So you work remotely, right? You're in Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah, sort of. It's pseudo remote. We have like several hubs in CrushPath. There's actually five of us now in Columbus. So we do work out of a co-working space, but we have a dedicated office here. So I work remotely with the team in San Francisco, but a couple of people are also working remotely with me. We're usually not on the same projects, but we just share the office space. So we have an office to go to.
That's neat. That's actually a nice situation.
Yeah.
Now that you're at CrushPath, you mentioned you have a passion for teaching, and I've seen you give presentations before. Do you do any internal training or working with other team members to talk about best practices, what you're doing?
Not necessarily here with CrushPath. I'm still pretty active. I actually just with my personal blog, I just redesigned it and republished it on a different platform just to kind of expand my skills. But yeah, my blog is where I like to write a lot of how-to articles. Anytime I come across, you know, maybe a difficult JavaScript problem that I need to solve, or a neat way to do things with a PHP file, anything I have to research and figure out, I usually turn around and write out what I did in a tutorial and post it to my blog. And that is helpful to me in the future, because I often you know, need to know what I did in a certain situation. So I go back, not to the code that I wrote, but to the blog post I wrote, because in the blog post, I usually strip out the specific code, like anything that was not directly related to the solution, and just put the bare bones solution in the blog post. So I'm able to figure it out quicker.
Nice.
Having written it down.
Nice. All right. Well, let's have you educate our listeners about error pages. Let's just start with the basics. What is an error page?
So an error page, you know, anytime something goes wrong in the handshake between the client and the server. So sometimes that's going to be the server's not working correctly. Sometimes it's you're requesting a file that's not there. And sometimes it's you're trying to poke around the site in a place that you're not supposed to be. So there's a variety of reasons why an error might be returned from the server, but typically it's to signify something has gone wrong.
And what are the standard error pages that a user might see?
So you've got your set of redirect errors, which you actually don't see those. The server sends out like a redirect. If, for example, you go to a page that has moved, you can tell the server to tell the browser this page has moved, and then the URL on the browser will automatically switch over to the new place. So if you ever like type in a URL and, you know, it blinks and then it goes somewhere else, that is actually an error of sort. Well, I guess it's not an error. It's just a redirect code. As far as the actual errors that you're probably going to see, there are errors are split up into client errors and server errors. So the client errors that you're most likely to see, they all have status codes next to them. So the 403 error is a forbidden error, means you're trying to go somewhere you're not supposed to. a 404 error, which is what I gave my talk on last year at EECI, is about the file not being found. And with Expression Engine, as we'll probably get into, it's you kind of have to set that up and have a strategy for how are you going to handle that these files are not found. And then a 408 error happens when the request has timed out. So if you're trying to do something complex on your server and process something a while to show the page and the server times out, it takes too long, they might see that error. In all of these, there are default error screens that every server has. So if you ever just see like a black and white, just real big letters says like 404 error, that's just the server's default. And then the final one is the most common server error you're going to find is a 500 error. It just says internal server error. And that, the thing that kind of stinks about that is that it's not very specific at all.
No, so, it's not. No. It's actually the most frustrating one.
Yeah, it's the hardest to debug.
And that really is one that hits developers the most, it seems, because if a user is seeing that, the developer has not done their job, right?
Correct, yeah, that's something wrong with the server. And I usually get those whenever I'm messing around with the htaccess file.
Yep.
You know, I'm doing something clever, and all of a sudden my server's broke. So.
Yeah, or not so clever.
Right, exactly.
So, Brian, you mentioned, at least with the 404, there does need to be a little bit of setup, but generally speaking, these errors you mentioned, do they just come automatically on the server, or is there something that needs to be set up in order to enable the user to see these errors?
All these errors will come, like I said, by default, there's just the white and black simple error message that the server has. And it's not pretty, it's not useful, it's not branded, it's not even informative, and the fact that they highlight or make real large the status code, I mean, as a user experience person, you know that that's not something you want to do. You don't just want to be shouting error codes at your visitors. You know, the best thing you can do is guide them along and explain in human terms what's going on here and how they can resolve the issue. So, yes, it does come out of the box with these error pages, but it's definitely a great practice to customize these.
Do you customize all of those or just the, sort of the, I mean, are you customizing a 500 page?
I have not yet customized
either.
A 500 page, but in kind of doing a little bit of research before this podcast, I came across some pretty interesting articles that people have written about customizing their 500 error page, some pretty cool things that you can do with that. So I typically do customize the 404 page. That's mm-hmm. a pretty standard one a lot of people do. Beyond that, I haven't, but I think I might start rethinking the 500 error page. Not that my servers ever have that.
So what did you find in your research? That you could configure it to pull more information so you actually knew where the error was originating from?
Well, sadly, no. Ew. But what you can do is probably the coolest thing I thought somebody do is, first of all, they designed it so that, you know, at least instead of a black and white screen, there's the branding going on so that you know that you're on the right site. But they had a form on there that said, let us know if you see this page or if we can help you out in any way. And then it also gives some kind of offline contact methods like the phone number in case you want to call the company. I also have found that you don't just want to put it on them to contact you. Like it's also a good idea to just automatically send yourself an email.
Yeah.
So that you know that the 500 error page is being tripped. And one company I saw, they put like an email input box so that if you want to be notified when the site's back online, they'll send you an email. So
interesting.
Just a few interesting ways to customize that 500 page so that they can get in touch with you in another way. I mean, because maybe they're just coming to your site to find your phone number. At least you can give them that, you know.
So if you're customizing the 500 page to automatically send an email to you if it ever loads, that form is automatically submitting when you load that page? Or how are you doing that? How are you configuring that?
You know, I'm not sure how much you can do on a server-side level. I probably wouldn't trust anything on a server-side level if your server's not working right. But you can, let's say, if you just serve up a basic HTML page, mm-hmm. you can have a form on there that submits to another site that you have, like a third-party site somewhere set up. And you can also, because it's loading front-end code, you could load your JavaScript, and I guess you could probably
do an auto-submit.
Yeah, you could do like an Ajax auto submit or something like that.
Got it. Okay.
So you mentioned that you've frequently customized your 404 pages. So let's talk about those just a little bit. It sounds like the goal of these messages is to inform the user that something's happening, but the default messages don't really tell them what's happening. So in terms of customizing your 404 pages, what are you adding to tell your visitors, your users, when they visit that page?
Well, again, one of the things that's important to do is reinforce your branding, just so that they can be sure that they're comfortable that, yes, you are on the right site. You know, because a lot of times they'll get the 404 page because they came to a bad link from another site or maybe an outdated search result. So, you know, they land on your page. The first thing you want to do is reassure them, like, hey, you're in the same spot. Don't hit that back button. And then the best practices, I would say, are to maybe apologize for the error. Real briefly, explain what happened in layman's terms, even explain what might be responsible for this. But, you know, again, you don't want to go too copy heavy because they're not sitting there trying to read all your 404 explanations.
No, they're not.
but probably the most useful thing you can do is explain what to do next. And there are some, you know, useful things that you can do with Expression Engine, especially because it is a dynamically generated page that you could try to guide them in the right direction. At the very minimum, give them a link to your homepage. Even better might be to give them a link or to list out your navigation if it's not already in the template that you serve. Maybe even if it's a blog, you know, show them some of your most popular blog posts that most people are trying to get to anyway. You could at least maybe hit, you know, that 80% of the people that might be there in the first place. So
that's a good idea. As developers, what do you think we miss or forget to include when we're building out these custom 404 pages?
I would say a lot of times it's just simplicity. You know, developers, it's hard to find a designer and developer that are equally skilled at both. So a lot of times if the developer is the one building the 404 page, it might be overly technical. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I've even heard a lot of people say, don't even use the term 404 because it's like, what do they care? What do they know about the error
right.
for, you know?
So what would you use instead?
Well, just say page not found or oops, you know, we're going to fire Ronnie or, you know, turn it into a story. That you
know, Ryan.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that brings up something that I've seen often, you know, blog posts about like the best 404 page messages, many of which are really funny. Do you think that that's a good direction to go in?
As long as it handles the important thing of explaining what's going on, you know, funny is great after they're in on the joke too. Mm. So like, instead of, you know, saying like, you know, disguising it as a entry and having something funny on there, you know, hey, be like, hey, you know, we are definitely, you're on the wrong page. We're sorry. And if you have like something funny, like a photo or something cute, maybe even a video I've seen. As long as you're pretty sure that they're understanding of what's going on there and they're okay with a little laugh. But yeah, I would never put something funny in there at the expense of confusing the visitor.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I've seen one that I loved, and it was a video. It was quite involved, though. But it was that the 404 page where I can't remember the company, but it was sort of this whole battle scene. You know, there's these people, there's helicopters flying over, and you know, army in the fields, and you know, they're searching for this 404. Or they killed the page or something. It was just so incredibly elaborate and well done. I wish I could actually point people to it, but. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, I've seen that. I actually played the video in the talk I gave at ECI, but it's I can't think of the name of the company either. I'll look it up afterwards and we can
post that in the show notes.
Yeah,
quite elaborate.
Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about customizing, in particular, the 404 page to give your user a little more context and information beyond. Customizing the actual content the user sees. When we're talking about 404 pages in EE, what are the other things that we need to think about?
With EE specific, so you're talking about like...
really, like how does Expression Engine handle these page errors?
Gotcha. The parse order of an Expression Engine page, if you're ever bored and looking for some exciting reading, check out Lowe's PDFs on the parse order of an Expression Engine URL. But
Can I just interject and say most of us can't even understand that document?
I think at one of the EECI talks, I think it was like Lo started off saying like, you know, we're here to, you know, who here understands the parse order? And EE Hulk tweeted like, false question. Nobody understands parse order. But yeah, it's confusing, but it's time well spent as an EE developer to learn what's going on, because it also kind of unlocks more that you can do with an EE template to know what's being parsed when. But a URL parser for Expression Engine, first, there's a whole set of rules. But what can happen with EE is a lot of times somebody can add extra URL segments to a URL and it'll still load a page just fine. For example, if you just take your average blog post URL and just add another slash and start adding a bunch of random characters afterwards, it'll still generate that page out of the box.
Is it ignoring those additional segments?
Yeah, it'll just ignore them. I mean, they'll be there for you to use as, you know, your segment variables. But okay, for the most part, if they're not anything related to pagination or categories, the parser will just leave them alone, which can be a negative thing, because somebody can start, you know, adding, like they can create a valid URL to your site that will return a 200 status, which earlier when I talked about those status codes, 200 is the code that means everything's okay, and that tells Google to go ahead and index this page and all that stuff. So somebody could like type in some more words after your URL and then start linking to that around the internet, and you know that sort of URL might start getting picked up by Google.
Yeah, so that could be a problem.
Yeah, you're letting other people control the URLs that Google points to. So you can see where that can be a spam issue. Somebody fooling around with your search results, I'm not sure. But
and is that because Expression Engine defaults to the dynamic equals yes parameter? So it makes some assumptions from these URLs that are being called?
Well, it's actually a feature, because you can use that power to pass along some complex variables to use in the template by using the segment variables. So all you want to do in those circumstances is just check. If you're building out a template that's going to be your single entry blog post, and you know that it's not going to have pagination, and you know that you're not building any other URL parameters off to the end of it, you can just say of segment 3 or whatever the last one after the last segment is, you can say like, if segment 3 is not empty, then send them to the 404 page. Okay. Redirect equals 404. So that's a manual thing that you have to do within each of your templates, is just to check, you know, I don't want any other URL segments after 3 or after 4. If there are any, just kick them back to the 404 page. Or what some people do is they just strip those out and do a 301 redirect. So if you were on a blog post / blah, 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 it would just basically chop that off of the URL.
Oh, interesting. So then what Google would index is really the correct, or the developer's version of what is correct there.
Correct.
That's a great idea. I have to interject here. I've recently had an issue with this where I didn't know this was necessarily happening. I didn't have these custom 404 in some of my major templates on a project, and I didn't find this until I actually installed New Relic on this project. And that's I won't get into what New Relic is, but I installed it and I started to see that some of the pages that were having major performance problems, or the page loads that were having performance problems, were these ones that weren't correct URLs. And because the segments were incorrect for various reasons, those page loads were, you know, in the 20 to 40 second time, because the Expression Engine was trying to do its work. It was trying to do the job correctly, but these segments were not valid ones. So it was really ending up loading an enormous amount of data that it didn't need to, or doing large search to try to figure out what to load. And it eventually was loading something, but it never was valid content. And so I was quickly able to identify that and get these custom 404 redirects in there. And I eliminated that issue. And that actually was a huge benefit to my database. So
did you use the approach that Ryan just described about saying, you know, if segment X is not blank, redirect? Is that what you did?
I did that in some cases. One place where I couldn't do that was on a category detail page. So I had to run a query that first validated whether it was a valid category. So if that segment was a valid category segment or category URL, URL title, then I would load the page. If not, I would 404 it.
So, Ryan, I'm curious. Anna describes a situation where she had a site that was triggering some 404 errors that she didn't even realize were happening. Is there some sort of way to look up logs of 404 errors or view them from the control panel?
You know, I don't think that there is an Expression Engine plugin right now, or add-on, I should say, that does that. I tried searching for one. I Googled it. I looked on Devotee. I even asked out on Twitter. I know that there are some for WordPress, because those are all the search results that kept coming up. And it seems like, unless I'm missing it, that would be a great add-on.
It's a
for
nice little opportunity.
Yeah, a little module that you know have a little display in the control panel that shows the 404 errors that are being triggered. There are a few other plugins, though, that I know that there are some that will email you when somebody hits a 404 page.
Oh.
So that one will send you an email not only of the URL that was hit, but the template that triggered it. So oh, very.
And that's an Expression Engine add-on?
Yeah. That's from Chad Crowell. That's called a CAF 404 email.
I have not heard of that. So that's good to know.
Yeah, it's a handy little plugin that will do that.
So in my case, with my templates, you know, it wasn't throwing a 404 page or 404 error. That was sort of the issue, was it wasn't doing that. So how do you track that down unless you are constantly really watching the URLs that are loaded? I mean, if there isn't an error throwing, but there really should be.
Yeah. That's a great question. I know that there are server logs. I mean, you asked also, like, is there somewhere on the server? You can check your server log just by going into the root of your hosting. You know, typically there's some sort of log, or you'll see a folder that looks like it's related to error logging. But that's just basically a text dump of all this, you know, everything going on the server. And so you kind of have to find, you know, hit Control F and look through for the 404 code, but
yeah, it can be a little overwhelming.
Right. Yeah. It's not very intuitive. So yeah, I don't know. I would say in your case, probably something like New Relic or some of these other tools, you know, that's why they're there, is there's a hole that needs to be filled.
Well, obviously I didn't start the project right. I mean, you're saying that's part of your build process, that you make that redirect. I mean, you make some assumptions about what is a correct page load and what isn't, and then you code around that.
Well, and your problem also sounds like it's coming from the processing power of loading that template. So if you're checking the URL for certain things, every time you do any kind of checking or looking up or comparison, I mean, you're adding a little bit of load. So, you know, in those cases, I would say if you're starting to do some fancier or creative things with your programming, like it sounds like you were doing, is best practices just along the way, test the failing version, like what you're looking to test against. So kind of like make yourself fail by always entering in the wrong data and see what happens and how
long
it takes.
Makes sense. I mean, as developers, I don't know that I go to that place. I don't know that I do that enough. So I actually am going to start making a little concerted effort to make the site, the page load fail. I'm assuming everybody loads it correctly. That's not my job. Actually, I need to be mitigating those failures. So that's actually very good advice.
Now, Ryan, does anything need to be done in the htaccess file when it comes to 404 pages or other errors?
Well, that depends. If you're using the index.php removal tricks that most of us do with an Expression Engine site, every URL that gets typed in that doesn't, I mean, depending on the technique that you're using, but every URL that somebody types in that doesn't directly correlate to a file or folder on your server will go through Expression Engine's index.php. So in that case, the majority of your 404s you can handle right there within Expression Engine by using their, you know, the tools that they have as far as enabling strict URLs and all that stuff. But outside of that, you can, with the htaccess file, write down some commands that will say which, like you can direct a particular HTML file to be loaded when somebody hits a 404 error or a 500 error. So that's where you can build that custom 500 error page. Just by writing in your htaccess file, you know, when a 500 error is occurred, open up 500.html.
Mm-hmm. So I know based on my experience that sometimes the 404 error page as coded or configured in Expression Engine will load, but the header error that's returned is not correct. It's a 200 header. So how can we verify as developers that the correct 404 header message is being displayed or served?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's not something you see by default anytime you look at a page.
No.
So there's a couple of methods. Probably the designer-friendly method is just by going to a website that just Google check your header status. One site is sitestatus.net. It's a free service where you can just type in the page and URL and it'll tell you what the status code returned is. But for people who are more developer-minded, you can use your web inspector. I use Chrome, so it has web inspector, but there's Firebug, and Safari also has a web inspector. But you can go to the, I believe it's the resources tab. No, it's under network. And it shows all the files that were loaded with that web page request and their status message.
Oh, nice.
So that's not only useful just for the page itself. You can see like, hey, this is actually, my 404 template is actually returning a 200 status. But you can see if there are any other files that are being called, like an image or a font, something that's being called from your HTML that's not loading. And maybe you're not noticing it, but that you'll see that, you know, a 404 error in there. So yeah, you'll see that your if everything's configured correctly, if you trigger a 404 page, when you open up the web inspector and look at that tool, it should say 404.
Got it. I use Firefox as my main browser, and I use the web developer add-on, and it under the info section, header, toolbar, whatever, they have a view response header link there. So that actually gives me some neat information too, or additional info.
Nice. I want to change tacks just a little bit and talk about EE error messages that aren't really tied to these sort of default server messages that we've been talking about, like a 500, 404. What I'm thinking about are like system messages that get presented to the user if, for example, they submit a form and they haven't completed a required field. You know, EE delivers some standard error messages that go to the user. Have you, Ryan, ever customized those kind of messages? And if so, like, what sort of approach did you use, or add-ons did you use?
I have not customized the messages themselves. I've customized the design of that page, simply because there are so many possible error messages that can come back. I just figured whatever, I trust in the system, I guess. And every add-on as well. I know, for example, Soulspace's Freeform, you know, they'll return those messages if you are not submitting a required field or if it's not formatted correctly. So just by customizing the design of those pages in Expression Engine, it goes a long way. That's under the Design tab under Message Pages, and then you select User Messages. You can customize the design of that, but that it's not based off of a template. It's just based off of like a dumping in the HTML with a few variables in the right spots there. So without an add-on, you're kind of stuck. Like if you want to reproduce your header, you'd have to manually copy and paste it. You can't just include your header template.
Right.
So there are add-ons out there, I believe, that allow you to customize those error message pages. But typically, I just keep them pretty simple and again, reinforce my branding of the site on those pages. But I just leave the messages alone.
I've had to, on a couple projects, had to customize these error messages quite significantly. And I'm a big fan of the custom system messages add-on. It allows you to really just completely take control of those system messages in your actual template. And in my case, I was building sort of a custom My Account area where we were pushing a lot of the actions into overlays. So I really needed custom fine-tuned control of those error messages so I could point people backwards or point them forwards and get them to where they needed to go. So that it, for anybody out there that really needs that finite control over those messages, take a look at custom system message add-on. It's great and it's really relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It looks like it's from Brian Litzinger at BullMinded, $15. Anna, when you were using that, does it let you embed other templates or use snippets or global variables?
I don't see why not. You're running everything out of a normal template.
Nice.
So, and you can write conditionals. So if it's X error, you can have it deliver this copy. If it's this other one, you can have it deliver unique copy for that error. So you really have amazing control over it. And it moves everything into the templates.
Nice.
The biggest issue I have with the default system messages and expression engine is that you don't really have a lot of control over them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the design control, but we don't have much more control than that. And so this tool is amazing. This add-on, I really highly recommend it if you have to get into the nitty-gritty of those errors.
Excellent. Well, before we close up the talk today, Ryan, I just wanted to ask, do you have any just general tips or suggestions for our listeners about handling errors and communicating errors to users?
Yeah, just to reiterate, you know, what I said about, I've read the book Don't Make Me Think by
Steve Krug.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great tool. In fact, even just remembering the title, if all you get away from it is just thinking, whatever I'm doing, don't make the user think.
That's probably that's enormously huge advice right there. We probably don't even read the book.
Yeah. And also, you know, we talked about EE errors and we said something about Soulspace's freeform, how you'll get an error message if you forget to submit a required form field. I like to use jQuery whenever possible, or just JavaScript, to do some front-end error checking if you can before it gets sent to the server. Because not only do you save them time in going back, submitting a form and then coming back and risking losing data that they may have entered, but it also just gives them that immediate feedback, like, hey, this doesn't look like an email address. Can you reformat it?
Right. And as the developer, you're in control of exactly what they're going to see and with the flow and the look and feel of it all.
Right. So just always be thinking kind of defensively when it comes to programming and design. Just what could go wrong? How can I prevent that in building the tool or the site so that errors are minified if possible?
So when you're doing that, like jQuery form validation, for example, are you rolling your own, or is there a widget or an add-on or something that you like to turn to?
Well, there are two. One is I use the jQuery validate plugin, and that's kind of out of the box, super simple, easy to, you know, I think I've used it on almost every site since I've discovered it. It's incredibly easy to use. Another one that I use that I've found ties in well with a lot of EE add-ons, for example, with Soulspace's favorites. I know I'm like saying a lot of Soulspace ads here, but their favorites module is cool because when you click that you want to favorite an item, it will basically take you to a template that just says the message, you know, added to favorites. And it's it's meant to be used in a way that harnesses Ajax a little bit more than just actually taking them to that template and showing them, yay, we've confirmed this. So there's another plugin called the jQuery form plugin that allows you to really easily do Ajax submits. And then when it'll read that page or that success message that you get, and then you can just tell it what div to dump that message into. So it's nice because they click favorite and then you can change the star to yellow or say successfully added to favorites and then have it fade out. So it's kind of a neat way to do some form handling by submitting it via Ajax. And then if there is an error code there, I know some people have used that with kind of in conjunction with the system messages for like logging in and stuff like that. You can actually take those messages and display them in line.
Nice. Well, that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And hey, Ryan, where can listeners find you online?
You can find me on my blog at ryanbattles.com. You can also find me at Ryan Battles on Twitter.
Great. And we hope to find you on the Stack Exchange site, Ryan.
Yeah.
Pop in every morning with coffee.
All right.
Thanks again, Ryan. And thank you, Anna, so much for filling in as co-host.
Well, I can't thank you enough for the invite. Happy to fill in going forward. I am thrilled to have done this. This is my first time on radio. So awesome. I could do this for a living. Might be my new job.
Awesome, you guys. Now we'd like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Entry Analytics and Pixel and Tonic. We also want to thank our partners, Engine Hosting, Devotee, and EE Insider. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about the podcast, make sure you follow us on Twitter at EE Podcast or visit our website, ee-podcast.com. Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when EngineWorks' Carl Smith is joining us to talk about work, life, and finding balance. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, ee-podcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics. This is Emily Lewis signing off for the Unofficial Expression Engine Podcast. Cheers!